This is Annabelle Steele, and you're listening to the Hayseed Scholar from Professor Brent Steele. You may call him Doctor. I just call him Dad. Here's my Uncle Kyle to introduce the show.
Recording in studios from Utah to the UK and anywhere in between, you never know where Professor Brent Jameson Steele will be dropping knowledge and bringing you the best guests the universe has to offer. This is the Hayseed Scholar with Mr. Worldwide, my brother, Dr. Brent Jameson Steele. I like that one.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Hayseed Scholar podcast. I'm Brent Steele. Thanks so much for listening. Today's guest is Sebastian Kampf of the University of Queensland. Dr. Kampf is not the first guest from UQ. That would be our mutual friend and friend of the pod, Matt McDonald, also host of the pod on occasion. Seb was in town, in Salt Lake City, actually, visiting to give a talk based on his Global Studies Quarterly article on modern lawfare that he co-authored with Neil Rennett. And then Seb was also kind enough to have a screening and post-film discussion of his co-produced film, Theaters of War, How the Pentagon and CIA Took Hollywood. So we had a ton to be able to talk about. And this was, for me, the culmination of a wonderful few days with Seb. We put him up in the University Guest House at the University of Utah, and then I was able to get a studio time at the University of Utah Studios in the Marriott Library. And so the quality is about as good as you're going to get for this podcast. I cannot say the same for some of the other episodes that we've had over time. And some of the future episodes are probably going to have some issues as well regarding sound quality, because I am currently recording this intro at the International Studies Association Conference in San Francisco, where I also plan to do one more recorded episode. So I won't go over Seb's amazing story right now, since I can't really do it justice, or I guess properly represent it as stylishly as Seb does in this conversation. But I guess the top lines in his story and journey are that he was born and grew up in Germany. There was the fall of the Berlin Wall when he was entering his teenage years that had a big impact on him, as did his parents', I guess, emotional reactions to that moment, which he talks about very poignantly and fascinatingly. He also was a conscientious objector when he was younger, and thus he did not serve in the German military, but his service was, in some ways, his service that was alternate to that was even more challenging, as he talks about. I'll just kind of let him explain that. He discusses going to uni in Germany first before transferring to the LSE for his bachelor's and master's, which headed him towards an academic track. He would continue that track and even launch from it at Wales Abbor at the University of Aberystwyth. And it's there that he worked under Nick Wheeler and Alistair Finlan, among others. His first gig was a postdoc working with Alex Bellamy at UQ, where he has been ever since. He was hired as a lecturer a few years later. He then discusses how the Theaters of War film project came about, what that was like, and then concludes with the typical topics that we cover in this podcast: how he approaches writing, what he does to unwind, and how he and Matt McDonald will likely become the next big indie rock band, as they're currently playing venues. I'm not even kidding. They are currently playing venues in Brisbane. I hope to see them in person doing this, because it sounds like they've achieved almost cult status at this point. Matt plays instruments. I know that he plays the guitar. I've heard him play the piano, and it sounds like Seb has the really wonderful voice that goes along with that. So I'm hoping to be able to see them perform at some point with their musical talents. In any case, it was a great conversation and time with someone I hope I can just confidently call my friend, Dr. Sebastian Kampf, on the Hayseed Scholar Podcast. Cheers. Dr. Sebastian Kampf, welcome to the Hayseed Scholar Podcast.
Well, awesome to be here. Thanks for having me, Brent.
And I know you're dealing with still a little bit of jet lag, so hopefully this will keep you going. I know it'll keep me going because there's just so much here that we can talk about in the short time that we have. So in the beginning, you were born in Germany, grew up a little bit in Germany, yes?
I was born in Switzerland,
Okay.
actually, in the city of Basel, but only because my parents lived just across the border from there in Germany. You know, the Swiss are as blood-obsessed with their citizenship as the Germans, so it just happened to be the better hospital there, and so my sister and I were born there, but grew up in southwestern Germany. Yeah.
Would that have been the German-speaking area of
Yeah,
Switzerland? Yeah.
absolutely.
So what was growing up like?
Oh, it was a very protected, cushy childhood, you know, like a small village called Bad Krozing. I think then it had like 8,000 or 10,000 inhabitants. It has subsequently become a city, but you know, back in those days, absolutely not. And we lived on the outskirts of this, so like literally fields, nature. You've got the Black Forest Mountains right there. And so it was a lot about going hiking on weekends and playing outdoors. And my parents were very strict in terms of TV time. I mean, not that there was much on. There were three TV channels, plus the Swiss one, because we were so close to the border, which helped in terms of being able to understand Swiss German. But yeah, it was like just spending a lot of time outside and with friends and enjoying nature.
This would be in West Germany at the time, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay,
Yeah.
so growing up, well, before we even get into that, what was school like? What was your
I liked
schooling?
it.
Yeah, when do you start school?
When you are six, so you've got 4 years of elementary school.
Okay.
And then the system up to this day is just really crazy. So like then you have to sit exams in your fourth grade, and that determines which of the three subsequent schooling options you're going to go to. So there's one where you would go to the most basic continuing school for 5 more years, and then you would be online to do an apprenticeship and, you know, become a baker or a mechanic and that sort of stuff. And
How old are you when you take these exams then?
Like 10. Yeah, I know. And it's
Is
just
there pressure?
really
I mean, do you feel pressure then?
I mean,
or
I didn't really feel that I was, you know, good enough. But like, you know, it's so early to determine a kind of a child's future. And then the second option is like what's called Realschule, where you would then kind of, I think, have like 6 more years. And then the kind of, you know, to get to the A levels, that's the third option, which you end up with A levels and then can go to university. So that's what then determines it. And for that, the high school I then went to and to do my A levels was in the neighboring village, Staufen, even smaller, 6,000 people. But it was a city already because it had this medieval castle and a marketplace and very stunning and very pristine and very beautiful. And some of my best friends were from that village. And, you know, students came from all the surrounding villages to that high school with over 1,000 students.
So you were a good student?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know. Yeah, very geeky in a way, you know, but I liked it. I enjoyed high school and had some wonderful, wonderful teachers. Also had some crappy teachers, but some
Sure, we
really
always
wonderful
do.
teachers, who to this day left a mark on me in many ways. But also high school became, through all the kind of student council stuff there, a big thing that I got involved in, and that kind of helped me, you know, become more confident in myself and also taught me a lot of things about, you know, you can take initiative and set certain things up and yeah.
What did your parents do?
My mom was a a teacher for French, English, and music.
What
and
grades? Probably high school, maybe?
Or elementary school, and then that first type of school I just described, mm-hmm. right, where you have like 9 years overall of education. So that's what she had been doing, and she had been working in Brussels at the European School for a number of years. Then she met my dad, and then, you know, they settled down there. My dad's a pharmacist.
Oh, okay. So they're both educated with university degrees. And so was the assumption for you and your sister once the path became very clear, that you would be going on to university? Or?
Yeah, very much so. That was never questioned. Right? Mm-hmm. Both my parents had studied. And, you know, you should bear in mind that for at least the female generation of my parents, that was not a given. So in the case of my mom's, she's got a brother, my uncle, and it was very clear in their household with my with my grandparents that my uncle is going to study for sure. And then my granddad kind of was not in favor of my mom studying. It was my grandmother who stood up and said, if the son is studying, our daughter is studying too, right? I mean, the time was very different when my parents got married. Like, my mom would need to get a permission from my dad to open up her own bank account, right? Or you would have to get permission from your husband to get your driver's license.
That's right. And we even had that here in the States. I mean, I know for a credit card, you had to have your husband's, like, to sign for it in the 60s and 70s and everything. But
it's crazy. Yeah. It's absolutely crazy when you think about that. But in a way, you know, like, both coming from an educated background, it was very clear that that was the expectation that our parents had. And it was never really something that was discussed.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The period of time when this would be, so 80s, what
80s
was
and 90s,
yeah, yeah, so were you, what was it, a politically conscious sort of household? Did you have the conversations? Or I'm thinking about going into student council, student government. So, you know, being a little bit of a political animal was something that it sounds like you were manifesting, at least when you were in school. But world politics, geopolitics, national politics, was that ever on the kitchen table discussions at all?
No, not that much. I mean, it was more like a rebellion against my dad in many ways. He, to this day, is a member of the Conservative Party, the CDU.
Okay, so I was going to ask if he was a 68er the revolution.
No, no, absolutely or protest, not. I guess, not those hippies. and so, you know, just naturally felt very inclined towards the Green Party, a bit of the Social Democrats, but like that was sort of my orientation, and it was partially out of attraction, partially because, you know, I didn't want to support and didn't feel I could support what, you know, sort of the more conservative leanings. But surprisingly, there wasn't much political discussion at home. There was even not much of a discussion about sort of world politics, that sort of stuff. It was a very sort of, you know, wealthy upbringing. There was a lot of travel we did, you know, to various countries, and a strong interest in culture and in history that has had a huge impact on me and opened my eyes. But it was more like in terms of, you know, other worlds and other cultures rather than contemporary politics. Having said this, there were, of course, a couple of really important incidents that, you know, you couldn't evade. So take, for example, in when Chernobyl blew up, right? Yep. Like all this terrible, terrible fallout was brought and rained over that region where I grew up, and including others, of course. And I remember my cousins visiting us, and we had sort of decided we're going to camp out in the garden, and we were not allowed to do that. My dad got a Geiger counter, and, you know, there's a roof terrace at my parents' garden, and you would hold it and measure it under the roof, right? There was nothing, and as soon as you stepped a meter out, the Geiger counter would swing fully in that direction, you know, like the whole nuclear fallout there. So we didn't eat mushrooms for many, many years. Mm-hmm. We had like milk palva and those sorts of things. So like there was
a... Did you have to take iodine or what was the yeah, there no, were we, certain pills or whatever.
Yeah,
that,
yeah. No,
we some didn't. Folks in Eastern Europe had
no,
to take.
No, we didn't. Okay. We didn't need to take that. But yeah. So that kind of association with like the dangers of nuclear power, and that fed in really big time, of course, in the kind of anti-nuclear movement that was going on. And in the German context, especially driven by the Green Party,
I was just going to say this is Greens 101, right? Yeah, I mean, and really what they're associated with.
And, you know,
with
for those who are not too familiar, the Green Party has a really important role, has played a really important role in German politics, you know, currently being in government for the second time in their history. But mm-hmm. that kind of green movement that started had two points of origin in geographically in Germany. And one was that area there. Mm-hmm. Interesting enough, that has that originated from protest against a nuclear power plant that was supposed to be built there. And then, interesting enough, the kind of left-leaning alternative people in Freiburg, the next bigger city with mm-hmm. the university, the academics, came together with farmers to protest. So it had this really interesting mix of more conservatively leaning mm-hmm. agricultural folks and the kind of academia. And they managed to not have that nuclear power plant built. Mm-hmm. Right. And then the discussions from there emerged a lot like, but what's the alternative? And that's one of the reasons why, for example, Freiburg, you know, became the first German city with a green mayor, has been for a long time the solar capital of the world, you know, mm-hmm. with solar panels on the local soccer stadium and all that sort of stuff.
What were the interests for the farmers and those in agriculture? Was it just that the fallout from radiation was ruining their crops and ruining the soil for, okay.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And already a very long... lasting realization that, you know, despite the rhetoric of this is a very clean technology, mm-hmm. That we up to this day haven't figured out, like, what do we do with, you know, all those, with the uranium that comes from that. I mean, we only, all storage sites are only temporary.
That's right.
Right? And the costs of what the state has to invest is never included in the calculations when people talk about it's cheap and it's clean. Mm-hmm. So that was a realization very early on. And, you know, there was also early attempts in literally in the neighboring village about genetic crop. And there was a whole group of clandestine people in the network who would go there at night and just chop it down uh-huh. and all that sort of stuff. So there was a really interesting kind of political mix there. The other thing that, of course, was a political thing happening in our family was, you know, the end of the Cold mm-hmm. War and the fall of the Berlin Wall. And I was 13 at that time, 12, 13, and, you know, hadn't fully grasped what that meant. But I remember, you know, watching the news with my parents. And I mean, for me, early on, I realized that instead of having to go to bed at 8 o'clock, watching the news that started at 8 meant I could actually stretch it out to the quarter past 8. You know, and all I was after was kind of the sports news. But what happened there was like the news and my parents were crying.
Really?
You know, and it was
with relief or happiness or a combination maybe.
Yeah, totally. And never, you know, having able to imagine that would happen in their lifetime, you mm-hmm. know. And my dad always told us a story of when he was in high school that they went on a school trip to West Berlin and stayed with families there. And the family he stayed with, they would go every Sunday to a viewing platform on one side of the wall to wave at their son who was standing on the other side because, you know, he happened to have gone out that night and couldn't come back, you know? So, I mean, that sort of were early traces of where I felt like, oh, something really important here is at work.
Mm-hmm. So that would have been 13. You see the rest of the sort of breakdown of the communist governments in Eastern Europe at that period of time. But in high school, what was your favorite subject, like civics or government or history or whatever, or were there other interests? And were you in sports too? Or?
Yeah. Okay. Big time. Okay. Big time. So, I mean, like early on, I started off with doing athletics mm-hmm. and then tennis became my big passion, my big obsession uh-huh. even. And, you know, sparked by Boris Becker.
I was just going to say, I was thinking of the Germans.
Was a big, huge thing. I had his Puma records, you know, and that sort of stuff. And so that was, I remember like a good friend I'm still in touch with who would always complain. I call, you know, the landline to kind of, can we hang out? And your mom's always like, he's playing tennis, you know? So that was a huge thing for me, absolutely. But yeah, history was my absolutely favorite subject, and that was helped obviously by, you know, our parents taking us from an early age to say, like, I think the first trip was we went to Italy, and my mom's motto has always been, well, if we go somewhere, we also need to check out stuff. We not just hang out on the beach. And so they started off by exposing us, you know, to say like Florence for a day and then Pisa for a day, but then we have beach time and that sort of stuff. And they realized that my sister and I really responded well. And then we had regular family trips, say, to Greece, where we do like a proper 1 week tour of culture and then a week on the beach. And we did the same in Morocco and in Egypt and other places. And that was really, it was very privileged, but it really opened my eyes and sparked my interest. I mean, my first dream of what I wanted to become was an archaeologist. I wanted to discover pyramids. I was obsessed with pyramids. And then I came to realize that they're pretty huge and they probably have been all discovered already because they're so big. So that tainted that a bit. But to this day, you know, when you read somewhere that in the jungles of somewhere in Central America, they've discovered like a whole new city, it sort of comes back at me. It's like, wow, this is just fantastic. Yeah.
But so did Indiana Jones have a big impact on you then? Or?
Yeah. I mean,
I'm trying to think about when I probably wanted to be an archaeologist at some point as well. But but that was only because of Raiders of the Lost Ark or whatever.
How can you not? But it also has this, evokes these memories of me having just been had two of my wisdom teeth extracted and then watching this. And I kind of was zipping a bit of soup through a little straw. And then whenever Sean Connery made these jokes, I couldn't really laugh.
Right.
But, you know, it really tapped into this adventure. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And like years later, when I was backpacking through Vietnam and, you know, and you come across some places there, you know, when you've got overgrown jungles, overgrown temples and that sort of stuff, that, you know, you feel like you're in indie territory.
So how did you make the decision? How and when did you make the decisions or start the process for going to uni? Because I know that you had some options. You were also starting to, and we'll come back to this, starting to find an interest in making films, I believe, even in high school, right?
Not in high school. Oh, no. Like, you kind of started in high school where, we did a lot of things for the student councils, so much so that a TV channel ended up doing a documentary about what we were doing, and the director, the producer of that documentary, became a good friend to this day. And so there was an early exposure there, and I also interned with her because for a while I thought, like, oh, I'd love to do films. And then she at some point took me aside and said, well, I want to also explain to you the precarity of that of that world. And, you know, I've had this very cushy, sweet upbringing, and the idea that there couldn't be a steady income seemed to be impossible to me at that time, probably still to this day. But, you know, we've got 13 school years, and then there was still military service.
Okay.
I had to take the decision, and there was a very clear-cut one for me that I didn't want to do military service, so I'd become a conscientious objector. Which meant that military service would have been 11 months, but like social service was 13 months. And it's not that you kind of say, I want to do one or the other. You have to justify why you don't want to join the military. It's an interesting one. And then I split that. I worked for half the time at a closed psychiatric hospital away from my parents, sort of 2 hours north.
In what city?
It's a small village called Neunkirchen, which it's nothing much to talk about, but I deliberately wanted to expose myself to something that, touch wood, I would never see again in my life. And it was interesting. It was really tough as well, like literally a closed psychiatric hospital. So that specialized in providing a permanent home for people who have been through 7, 8, or 9 different institutions to try and find treatment for whatever kind of, you know, illness they had, and nothing worked. So you need to find a home for these people. So like this was kind of, you know.
So what would you do in the hospital itself? Like, were you like an orderly, or I mean, would you like just go in and clean rooms or whatever?
I worked in as a helper in the sort of physical therapies. You know, helping with them doing horse riding and crafts and arts and that sort of stuff. You know, and.
Did you stay there? Did you have lodging nearby?
Nearby.
Okay.
Nearby. But it was pretty heavy, and in a way it was too heavy for me. And so I transferred, and then I worked at the University Hospital in Freiburg in the administration of the civil servants there, because they had like 300 of them. So like I was one of two who helped the professional administrator with running that whole program.
So I'm pretty sure you're not the first conscientious objector I've interviewed, but I haven't pressed that topic with others. And so if you could indulge me, what goes into, at least in Germany at that time, it sounds like you have to write up a justification. There are forms and everything. So what was that like?
I was okay. I mean, you can there's various – I mean, it's changed now. It's a professional army, right? But back then – you had all these different institutions, including the church you could go to, and they would help you draft your letter. And, you know, like all your friends or like all your male friends do the same thing. So you kind of knew, you know, like, okay, my granddad told me these stories about the Second World War.
Sure.
I'd never want to shoot, have to shoot at another human being, that sort of stuff. So it was relatively straightforward, right? And then you have that interview with the military folks, and then, you know, they have to see if they accept your justification or not. And that was relatively straightforward.
Okay.
So what it meant, just coming back to your earlier question, is that, you know, that gave me that year or those 13 months to kind of try and figure out what it is that I wanted to do, right?
Yeah.
So, and it was actually really nice because you had a steady income, you know? There was a lot of money there for at that age to basically spend and party a lot, which was pretty great. And one of the things that, and then of course you had to face the question of like, what am I going to do? And I went through all these different things. So like, I mean, to the credit of my parents, my dad, as a pharmacist, he had his own pharmacy, was always, I think, hoping that either my sister or myself would at one point take over.
Yeah.
And when he saw how badly I performed in chemistry.
Because I was thinking all my friends that were pharmacists, and it was like organic chem. They just come back and bang their heads.
I could not for the sake of it. And I was a good student. I just couldn't understand it. And and I was a total social science student. That's where my strength was. So like, you know, chemistry, maths, biology to some extent were like, oh my God, terrible, terrible subjects for me. And so it became very clear, I'm not going to be the one. My sister was way too much interested in music and then subsequently psychology. So, but and to their credit, you know, they very early on said, well, whatever you want to do, we're going to support you with everything we have, right? As we want to make sure that you follow your passion. And so there was not, after that maybe initial disappointment, it was very clear. And also my parents were very, very open towards my sister and me in saying that they much rather invest in our education than giving us any inheritance because of the value of education, you know. And my dad, he had started studying medicine and then didn't really like it and shifted to pharmacy. And basically his parents then, they said, well, you can do this, but we no longer support you financially to do that second degree. So he had to work throughout, and he never wanted us to experience that.
Yeah.
So there was this really like incredible support, right, and endorsement. But it was hard to figure that out. So I remember like checking out sort of, I don't know, private management and business school sort of things at their open days. And I felt like this terrible crowd of people there and wasn't really convinced. I did this internship with that filmmaking friend, uh-huh. right? And for a long time, I thought maybe I'm going to become a high school teacher in history and maybe English or German. And then decided to start studying with political science and enrolled at the University of Bonn.
Okay.
And that's where I then went.
And how is the resident housing set up there? I mean, do you have like dorms at the University of Bonn, or is it?
Yeah, you have like dorms and like, you know, shared apartments and, mm-hmm. and that sort of stuff.
What year would this have been? Do you know when?
It would have been in 97.
Okay.
Late 97.
Okay.
When I moved to Bonn. And it was really great. It was one of the last years that the German government was still based in Bonn.
Okay. Yeah, right.
So
yeah.
You had the kind of proximity there. You could go to the parliament and watch some debates. Mm-hmm. And I interned with a Green Member of Parliament, Cem Özdemir, who was then the first member of parliament with a migration background from Turkey. Mm-hmm. He subsequently became the head of the Green Party, is now Minister for Agricultural and Food Consumption and that sort of stuff. So that was a really great experience. Having said this, my best friend from high school became aware of this program called International Relations you could study in the UK. Mm-hmm. And he's like, you should check that out, you know, at the LSE. That looks really interesting. And, you know, back in those days in Germany, you couldn't study international relations. It was either political science, and then you had, like, obviously a lot of political theory. Mm-hmm. You had parliamentary systems, and you had foreign policy as the three components there. But no one offered international relations, with the exception, I think, of one university then. And so this was a totally new thing. And but the application deadline had passed at that point, because in the UK it's so early on.
It is, yeah.
Right? And so I applied then for the following year. And that meant that like halfway through my first year, or like 8 months into my studying in Bonn, I got the news that I can go to the LSE with that friend from my best friend from high school, which was pretty cool. So, and that then triggered the move to the UK and the opening to, I guess, the world that we're in right now.
Had you been to London before?
Like my mom had taken me and a family friend maybe when I was learning English maybe for the second year on a trip. So I had some vague memories. But no, hadn't, you know, and I was too small from getting a sense of how gigantic that city is. You have to remember, I'm from a small village.
Yes.
And Bonn, even though it was the capital, wasn't exactly what we would call a big city or a world city, right? In fact, when I traveled back to Bonn many years later, and you had kind of stripped the government out, you know, it's like you realized how, in a way, provincial this has been. And with the government there, it just felt so much bigger, right? But, I mean, London was just, it took me half a year to get to a point where I felt like I love the city. The first half a year, it was very overwhelming, you know, studying in a foreign country, studying in English. Even though my English was very good,
sure.
You know, but all of a sudden you have to read those texts, right? And I remember that Spiros Economides, who I had as a tutor in the, I think, political IR theory course, we had to read for the first week Thucydides, the Peloponnesian War. Read the entire book. Read like two or three articles that kind of dealt with it. You know, and here I was sitting there, and this is just one of four subjects, right? And I remember sitting in the library, and the mistakes you do as a non-mother tongue speaker is, of course, you know, you kind of check out in your dictionary every single word you don't understand because you have to improve your English at the same time. It took me for an hour, I could read two or three pages, you know? And at some point, you know, halfway through the week, I'm like, I've now read something like 20 hours. I'm not going to finish this. And I remember I was sitting there crying because I just was not sure if I had it in me to actually do that, you know? And then my parents said, well, why don't you ask for advice with your teacher? And Spiros was amazing because he was saying, like, look, just stick with it. You know, in 2 weeks, you're going to read like four or five pages an hour, right? You have to work yourself into this rhythm.
You'll get conditioned.
You get better. And and also the, some of the other teachers were saying, like, look, you're here for your undergrad degree. So it's not about, like, you know, writing high distinction essays from the start, but it's to get to the point where you do it. So ultimately, what we're looking for is how you progress across. And, you know, we were 30 students in our year. We all had a personal mentor amongst the staff members who you would, you know, meet on a regular basis, and they would kind of track your progress across the different courses, across the terms, that sort of stuff. But it was just phenomenal. And, you know, like for amongst those 30 students, there were something like 18 different nationalities, right? And these became your friends, and it's like from, you know, all sorts of different places in the world. So, like, it was kind of like living in a globalized sense. And I mean, London and the UK at that time, you know, Tony Blair had just come to power, Cool Britannia. It felt like you're living literally at the zeitgeist of the age, you know, the LSE smash bang in the city center of London, right? And just like globalization happening. You had Tony Giddens giving these director's lectures on globalization.
That's right.
All that sort of stuff. It was just like you felt like you're experiencing, you're sitting at the cusp of what the world is becoming and the world moving closer together, right? So hard to understand these days, but that kind of was such an vital and important part of my experience of that.
And it I think it was like that a lot of places in the West, but each individual place, it manifested in a little bit of a different way, right? So there, it's a global you know, experience, whereas in the U.S., it's a hegemonic experience and or imperial experience. Were you also, obviously, in addition to your classes, there's the world around you. So was that coming up in conversations, the intervention into Bosnia and Kosovo and that kind of stuff?
Right? Oh, Kosovo was huge, huge. You know, like that was then March, April, right, 1999. Yes. So that would have been within the first year at the LSE. And I was very active in something called Europe 2020, European Student Parliament, that would meet you know, once or twice a year for a week in different locations, right, to debate things, and the kind of resolutions that we came up with would then be presented allegedly to the European Commission. Whether it had any impact or not didn't matter. But that was sort of a similar kind of like bringing people together. And the conference I went to, I think it was in Cambridge or in Oxford, coincided with the Kosovo War. So that was really massive. And do you know Nick Kiersey?
Oh yeah.
So Nick, I know through that Europe 2020, is the only academic I know who had also gone through that. So we've been friends through these kinds of experiences. We were like just really intense weeks, as you can imagine, right? But yeah, no, that was really big. That was really big. But yeah, like LSE London was just phenomenal.
And you stuck around for a master's, right? An M.
Yeah, there was
MSc.
Absolutely no doubt in my mind. That
really? So you knew already then?
Well, no, like towards the end of my undergrads, I knew that I definitely wanted to do a master's degree, and I knew I wanted to stay at the LSE. I loved it a lot, you know, and it was, for me, and I think maybe also objectively speaking, was quite a phenomenal department at that time, you know, and once you gotten to know some of the academic staff, you know, they were also very supportive and very open-minded, and, you know, be this, as mentioned, like Spiros Economides or Peter Wilson or Christopher Coker, who mm-hmm. had a big influence on me. Dominique Jacquin-Badal, who unfortunately died mm-hmm. way too early, but she was one of my personal mentors. And, you know, just really like phenomenal people. I'm sure I'm forgetting some mm-hmm. of them. Sorry if they're tuning in and I'm forgetting them. But you all had a massive impact to opening me to that world and creating that fascination in me. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And if I can single out Christopher Coker there, his course on strategic aspects in international relations was a real eye-opener in many ways. But, you know, when you come from a German upbringing, post-Second World War, mm-hmm. post-Holocaust, mm-hmm. The very idea that you could even dare to look at war mm-hmm. was impossible to imagine. What you do in German universities, you study conflict resolution and peace studies. Like anyone, at least back in those days, to some extent, from what I understand still now, if you are kind of doing war studies, you're already being looked at quite skeptically, mm-hmm. right? So for me, the idea of stepping into war and understanding it in its own right felt like mm-hmm. somewhere where I didn't want to go. And then you go to these lectures and it's just, I mean, anyone who ever seen him lecture is just phenomenal. Mm-hmm. Like it just opens you to a very different world and a very creative world. And you don't have to agree with sometimes where he was coming from or, you know, but it was just sort of gave me a sense of like, you can actually approach this topic, but you can approach it in a really interesting way. Mm-hmm. And so that really got me fascinated and hooked on war, on this war. Very, very dark subject, right? Which out of all the other topics triggered my biggest interests.
Mm-hmm. So because it was the master's program at the LSE, at that time, did you also get to participate in the editing of Millennium or
not? Yeah, I did in the special issue on, what was it, images and narratives in IR?
Yeah.
You know, I think with Ivor Newman writing like Grab the Phaser Ambassador and
yes,
those
yes.
ones there. Yeah, that was a great experience. You know, like as a master's student to be there, and that was working just on the special issue. Mm-hmm.
So how did you and when did you and where did you decide on PhD? So not just in the UK Academy, but were other academies on the radar, or did you know you wanted to, if you were going to go on to the PhD, to stay in Britain?
Mm. It sort of crystallized during the master's when I realized that I really liked thinking about questions. Mm-hmm. And then with the master's thesis, which, you know, I focused on Russia and Soviet and post-Soviet foreign policy in my master's a lot, and then wrote my master's dissertation on Russia and its relations with the West and mm-hmm. the different images and that sort of stuff. Margot Light was the professor mm-hmm. then. And I really enjoyed that experience. And so I thought like, okay, maybe a PhD could be something. And then talked to the professors I knew, and they sort of said like, oh yeah, I think you know, we could see that. And then I followed the recommendation to apply to Cambridge mm-hmm. and started my PhD in Cambridge. And long story short, after a year, or like very soon, I realized that's not for me, or if I don't make a change, this is never going to end. Mm-hmm. And then transferred to Aberystwyth. Mm-hmm. And we can talk about Aber in a second. But it was a mix of things in Cambridge. One part of that was me being a London fan, and then going to Cambridge, and it felt like, despite the architecture and the history and that sort of stuff, it just felt like living in a museum and in a medieval world. Mm-hmm. and living just not at the cusp of our time, right? I mean, I'm not even going to go into what the internet connection looked like back then. Yeah. I ran a campaign with my college to actually open that up, you know, and they were like, the person who had to decide. I mean, you couldn't even book a flight with your credit card.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. You couldn't really. And I found out that amongst all the colleges, the college I was in had spent the least money on the internet. And so I ran that political campaign, and I could speak in front of the college, board. Uh-huh. And the person who had to decide this was a historian of the Middle Ages. And I still have that email. I should say not the email, the letter, because they wouldn't send emails. Right. I still have the letter. And he wrote that because my argument was like, if you don't open this up, this is a research tool,
yes,
you know, more than anything else. And he wrote that we do not recognize the internet as a resource for learning. And if we were to open up the internet, as you suggest, to our students, not only would the college go bankrupt, but the entire internet would crash in and of itself. So, you know, and if I had graduated there, I would have had to kneel in front of that guy and kiss his ring.
Yes.
So,
yes.
So there was a certain arrogance I had, and I felt also, in retrospect, I wasn't ready. I wasn't in the right mindset for a PhD. You know, I hadn't made that kind of transition. But I also have to say that, you know, now Cambridge is a department and it's big. Back then it was a small center.
That's right.
It had one or two tenure track people. All the really good people would leave, you know, like Ian Clark, Tony Erskine had all left, mm-hmm, at that point. And I had a supervisor who was not in my field and who also didn't really take an interest, or maybe that was the Cambridge system. So we might have met like four or five times in the entire year.
Oh, wow.
And I had no guidance. Right, you were left to your own devices, and I would send him something written, and I'd rock up, and he'd be like, "Oh, are we meeting today?" It's like, "Yeah, I sent you 20 pages." It's like, "Okay, come back in half an hour." I'd come back. It's like, "Oh, that's fine," you know. And I'd test him out. I'd reference Mickey Mouse and Asterix and that sort of stuff. And obviously, he never read anything. And
then you put it in.
I became quite cynical about this, but then also like this became a problem because I realized, okay, this is not going anywhere. And you know, I'm one of those persons. I needed a system that forces me to narrow things down, uh-huh, right, and to drill me into that. And I didn't get that there. I was left to my own devices, so I kind of could never settle on a topic, mm-hmm, right? I was floating around. It was very creative, but it never really got to where you needed to go. And so I looked around, and I went to the University of Sussex, and Beate Jahn and Martin, mm-hmm, Shaw had sort of said, oh, yeah, we'd be interested in supervising you. And I had already set up a trip to Everest with, and I was like, oh, you know, I should go to Brighton, and that's like, but maybe I should check out ABBA. Mm-hmm. You know, I had set it up, and Tim Dunn was the,
sure,
in charge of PhDs back then, and I had 2 or 3 days in ABBA, and they rolled out the red carpet.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was also, it was sunshiny. It was very warm.
I was just going to say, you know, the opposite
of what it usually looks like. But it was sensational.
Mm-hmm.
I had meetings with 7 or 8 members of staff.
Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking about just what the staff was like back then, right?
Incredible.
I mean, and we've covered this with friends of the pod before that were there at that time, right?
Yeah.
But I mean,
yeah.
I can't imagine.
And I had the best conversations that, mm-hmm, I've had up to that point about what I wanted to do. And it was just like an exchange and a discussion and a challenge and a lab with every single one of them. And I remember that on the train ride back, I was kind of like, it dawned on me that, yeah.
This is it.
If this is supposed to work, then okay, forget about the remoteness and all of that sort of stuff. This is really in the interest of writing a PhD, this, mm-hmm, is where I need to go. So I applied and got accepted. And once I got accepted, I emailed Tim and said, hey, I'm not sure if I can ask for this, but, you know, I had wonderful conversations with everyone, but the one conversation that still stood out was with Nick Wheeler.
Nick,
and
yeah,
is he available perhaps? And so I got Nick as my primary supervisor, had Jan Selby at the beginning before, mm-hmm, he then moved over to Sussex. And then Alistair Finlan. And it was just absolutely wonderful. But that's sort of where I learned what it means to do research.
Yeah. Well, and this is right after Nick's Saving Strangers was published,
yeah,
right?
So that's right.
So did that shape what it was that you were going to do for your PhD thesis then?
The Saving Strangers?
Yeah.
No. No, okay. I mean, so, obviously it was.
And you have other people there, right? Like Tony Erskine and others that are doing stuff on the ethics of war and.
Yeah, so, I mean, Nick was an amazing supervisor. If anyone plays tennis, you might have come across this guy in Florida, Nick Bollettieri, who is known to have shaped a lot of professional tennis players, but he's known as a really tough one.
Mm-hmm.
And Nick was like. It was, you know, really sharp, to the point, very constructive criticism, but it was tough.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember that I would go, you know, always on the basis of something written, on a weekly basis, then mm-hmm. fortnightly basis, you know, like very, very regular meetings. I would send something in and I'd go to the supervisory meeting, and then afterwards it always felt like every single part is floating away. And yeah, then it took me like a day or two to reassemble. And then you start realizing that's how actually you progress.
Yep.
Right? And that was just amazing. And he was also great because he allowed me to just do my own research and mm-hmm. was supportive of that, and has this really, I mean, he's very passionate, but also this dedication and ability to engage you on your subject's terms, mm-hmm. right? I mean, obviously, I was doing stuff in a related field, right? But that was great. But also, just that it's not just your supervisory team, right? Mm-hmm. Nick and Alistair, but also just the department in and of itself. So the yes. encouragement was to just talk to other people. And of course, with what I was interested in, like the laws of war and ethics and asymmetric conflict and all that sort of stuff, you know, I had like very regular chats with Mike Williams mm-hmm. and Tony Erskine and Ken Booth and Colin McGuinness and Andrew Linklater mm-hmm. and Jenny Atkins and Richard Wynne Jones. And, mm-hmm. and that was just wonderful. And it was the lived experience of a department that kind of prided itself on bringing all the different strands that they represented mm-hmm. amongst the academic staff together, right? And to have conversations. I mean, one of the big illusions about ABBA has always been that, you know, they're all posties.
Mm-hmm.
That wasn't the case.
No.
I mean, there was obviously, you know, the very prominent critical theory, critical security folks, right? But there was very, conventional scholars in international history
yes.
and intelligence studies, in theory, in area studies. And it was the ability to have a conversation across, right? And that was great. And that was obviously always coming together in the weekly international political research seminar, where the final year PhDs would have to present in front of the entire department, all staff, all PhDs mm. in the old college, with academic readers engaging with that. And that was, you know, just fascinating to see.
And fellow PhD students at the time, some of whom were friends of the pod, at least the way in which some of them have represented this period of time, especially this period of time in that space of ABBER, although I think there's something that connects ABBER across times because of this, but it sounded like that you would go to a coffee shop or pub or hallways and you would have these conversations with fellow PhD students as well.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, it was wonderful for these purposes, right? I mean, it's so small that it's a close, tight-knit community and everything is within walking distance, right? I needed my sort of monthly doses of like going to London.
Uh-huh.
A bit of distance, right?
Okay.
And then coming back, it took me a while to figure out that was the perfect recipe for me.
Mm-hmm.
It was sensational. And, you know, like and this was the great thing that, whether you were a final PhD or first year PhD, you know, you had these conversations. So Patricia Owens was just mm-hmm. about to finish.
Mm-hmm.
I think Annick Wibben, same
uh-huh.
thing, right? And then, you know, in my year, like from Roland Folk, who is now at Hong Kong,
mm-hmm.
Sinderpal Singh, who is back in Singapore, Christian Kaunert and Sarah Leonard, who are, I think, somewhere in Europe right now, and Hugh Bennett. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like, I mean, it's just interesting to see how many of us have scored jobs in academia. And then the year after us was, you know, like Nick Vaughan Williams, yep. and Columba Peoples, and Keanu Driscoll, yep. Sumita Basu, you know, and so on, Harmony Toros. Mm-hmm. You know, it was just really, really interesting. And I think ABBA produced a lot of what then became academics across, you know, the UK
and the world too. Yeah. So were you, during this period of time, I think I mentioned to you the other day that I think the first time we met was just kind of a casual conversation at the San Diego ISA in 2006. Yep. James Derderian was there. I think Patricia Owens was there. My buddy Jack Amaro and I, and we were just chatting. Had you, was that your first ISA?
My first ISA.
Okay. So had you gone to BISA before that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, had gone to BISA.
And so for you, I'm thinking about all of the different geographic locations across the world that you were talking about regarding where other PhDs ended up. Was your network expanding a little bit in terms of geography or geographic locations, or was it when you were finishing up your PhD, the plan was to stay as much as possible in either the UK or Europe?
No, not really. I mean, okay. Honestly, I never thought I'd going to end up in Australia.
Okay.
But, I mean, one of the other great experiences during the PhD was that you know, it became clear that for the research I was doing on U.S. Wars in Somalia, Afghanistan, and so on, that it would be good to talk to decision makers in the Pentagon and in Washington and so on. So the idea was to, you know, base myself there and then, okay, where could I maybe affiliate myself with? And then Mike Williams was saying, like, well, have you thought of James Derderian? And I would have never dared. Or, you know, had the courage and stuff. He said, oh, just send him an email. And then James was like, sure, you know, come for half a year. So I had half a year at Brown.
Uh-huh.
And that was just very eye-opening, you know. Mm-hmm. That exposed me to the kind of, well, the Watson Institute that did across the board very interesting things. I got to know Anita Crawford.
Yep.
You know, and a couple of other staff over there. But James at that point was already big time into film and documentary making. Mm-hmm. He was teaching a course on film and IR that he co-taught with filmmakers. So he had 1 year, he had Errol Morris, and then he had another year, he had like Eugene Jarecki. So when I was there, it was Eugene Jarecki. Right, so there was a lot of, and students would learn about the theory, but also the actual practice of filmmaking, and their final assignment would be to make a film documentary, you know, taught by real professionals. And I was like, oh my God, I just would love to be a student here. Mm-hmm. But I could kind of, you know, tag along to a lot of these kinds of things. And he was producing his latest documentary at that time about sort of cultural sensitivity training in the military, that sort of stuff. So it was kind of really interesting to get an insight and a glimpse into that world. And, you know, like other stuff at the Watson Institute had been closely collaborating with, what was the Errol Morris one with? What was it again?
Fog of War?
That's right. Yeah, Errol Morris. So some staff members there were, you know, advisors on Errol Morris, Fog of War.
Yeah, and friend of the pod, husband, I, a Brown PhD, he actually was on the set with it. So we talked about it in our episode because I knew that he somehow got, you know, not only got to do that, but did do that and was sitting right behind Errol Morris as he's talking to Robert McNamara.
And so that just became really fascinating. Mm-hmm. But I had to realize that I've got my PhD, I've got my own kind of thing, but I felt like, wow, you know, like here is someone who is engaging in creative ways with a medium that has always had my interest and is making films. So I'd never imagined that that could be merged, right? But he kind of showed how, you know, that is something that, that you can do and can do this in a creative way. The other thing was that he had already then run a couple of symposia that, for example, for the cultural sensitivity training, right, where he brought this dispersed group of people together, be this like anthropologists and militaries and philosophers and artists and created a conversation that was really unique. And I mean, he has subsequently continued doing this with the whole Project Q thing in Sydney, that it was, you know, pleasure to participate in a number of those. But, you know, there was a lot of kind of ideas of how you can actually do things in a very creative, very interesting way. Yeah. So that was kind of where for a while I thought, like, oh, I'd love to, you know, if I could get a job or a postdoc at the Watson Institute, that'd be really cool. But you know how things are. You finish your PhD and then you kind of beggars can't be choosers. And it was a really bad time for someone coming out of a PhD to get on the job market in the UK because it was the end of their research assessment exercise cycle. Yes. It was like 5 or 7 years, right, where they bring the lineup, the ducks, so that they have, you know, all the good publications there. And so, you know, for someone without any publication to actually land a job, there weren't many jobs on offer, or it was like maybe like for 9 months or a teaching focused thing. So it was by constraints, in a way, had to start looking elsewhere. But also felt after then nearly 8 years in the UK, I was really up for a bit of a country change. I mean, I would always repeat Aberystwyth. I would always repeat LSE in the late 1990s, early 2000s. No doubt about it. But a bit more sunshine, you know, no carpets in bathrooms. Not having like taps that are like icy cold and boiling hot, and they're like 15 meters apart, you know, and like this sort of the moist that creeps through the walls in winter times and that sort of stuff. And I also wanted to be in a city, you know, just to kind of have a bit more of a city life with it. And and so then no, 3-year research position, sort of postdoc thing, funded through a big government grant with Alex Bellamy at the University of Queensland, came up, and it was on peace, non-Western peace operations.
Okay.
Like that's what I applied for. It was such a rigorous application process. They made me write, like, there was several stages, and I had to, like, at very short notice write an assessment of multilateral peace operation in the Central African Republic in the 1980s, you know? And at that point, I was very, you know, I was about to finish my PhD. I was like, I don't have the time, you know? And then, well, luckily, you know, talking to Rita Abrahamsen and a couple of people who could point me, like, oh, she's a good source, you know? Yeah.
You had some good folks that could provide some counsel.
Totally. So that kind of helped, right, to get me across the line there. And so, yeah, and so then it became, because that process got drawn out quite a bit, and then the offer came, and Alex was like, okay, but, you know, we need to actually know within like 4 or 5 days.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, because of the funding, right?
So that's sure. Everything. But you had to make that decision.
I had to make that decision at that very quickly short to move notice.
Literally across the world.
Yeah. But it was great, you know, like, again, you know, in ABBA, I talked to anyone I could possibly find, you know, what is about, you know, what is the right choice for me? Does that sound good? What is UQ like? And all the signals were extremely positive. So all of a sudden, I found myself September 2006. Jump on a plane and go to Brisbane, a place that you know, I never, I couldn't even imagine what it would be like.
Yeah. Well, and I'm thinking about that period of time, at least for me, and interviewing folks over the last few years, and then just even remembering the CVs and the movement of people. In the late 2000s and early 2010s, it felt like a lot of folks, including from the U.S. Academy, but also mainly from the British Academy, made that exodus to Australia. But you were already there. And so I'm wondering, like, when you got to UQ, you were working with Alex, but did you already know a lot of folks that were there? Or was it one of those where once you got there, you know, you started to...
Yeah, I didn't know anyone. I mean, I only knew Alex.
Yeah,
by name, right?
How was the transition then there? How was the getting to know everything, right? I mean, new country, a new city, a new department, a new
yes, university. And you know, a country that, I mean, I love traveling. It's one of my biggest favorite things to do, but I'd never taken an interest in Australia because my hunch was always, well, that's actually halfway around the globe, but it's actually very similar to what I know, and everything in between is so much more interesting, right? So my imagination was a bit like, well, there's desert, and back then I was saying there's Ayers Rock, we now know it's Uluru, you know, and there's koalas and kangaroos, and there's the Sydney Opera House, and then you arrive and it's like lush subtropical, green leafy Brisbane, and it's stinking hot and humid, you know, and you live in houses, wooden houses on stilts, and it's a great outdoor kind of quality of life and all that sort of stuff. So it was really eye-opening and something I didn't expect at all. And, you know, Australia, it's an immigration society, and you need to be a sociopath to not connect with people easily. They're so forthcoming and helpful. I guess my sense is that it's sort of, you know, they have all arrived at some point and they know what it's like, right? And I was lucky enough to make good friends early on, some of whom I'm still very close friends with now, like nearly 17 years later. Other friends, good friends have left, unfortunately, right? I didn't know anyone in academia there. I mean, Adam Cameron Scott, who was in the PhD year below me, he then moved back to, he was from near Brisbane and had lived there. He was a great source to have as well, by the way, when I was considering should I move, when he's like, oh, it's a great quality of life, you know, and with that, even with a postdoc salary, you're going to be fine, you know, that sort of stuff. So there was a connection there. But then I stumbled into, well, I should say that the first day I arrived, I first of all, I didn't know how to dress, right? And coming from the UK, I was like suited up with a tie, right? In this heat. Anyway, so I arrived there and then I run into this guy who comes in like flip-flops and shorts and this ramshackled shirt. Turns out, you know, Richard Chapgott, who then says, you must be the new guy. and then... You know, an hour later, I have like this shouting match between two of my alleged colleagues across the corridor. And what had happened was there used to be like two academics there who had published something that really like criticized publicly and really in inappropriate ways, you know, people like Alex Bellamy and Richard Davitek and others for, you know, being posties and endorsing and being against the Western governments in the fight against terror and that sort of stuff. And so it was a bit like, what did I get myself into? I should also say that that morning, when I had breakfast in West End, a nice suburb in Brisbane, I got the newspapers out, and Steve Irwin had just been killed by a stingray.
Okay, yeah.
Which, of course, is the first and so far only recorded time in human history that someone was killed by a stingray. But what surprised me was that there was these reports, and you know, the Irwin family and Australia Zoo is just 2 hours north of Brisbane. So it's a very close Queensland connection. And they had an official public holiday of mourning that was, you know, called for. But also there was reports in the newspaper that day of like all these dead stingrays having been found on the beaches of Australia, on Queensland, where Aussies had gone out with a knife to take revenge on Steve Irwin. And I'm like, what did I get into? You know, it's like
before you even done with breakfast, it's like,
But you know, despite that rocky start, it turned out to be like, I mean, still is like a very, very collegial, very great department or school, as we call it, to be in with some really spectacular colleagues and many of whom have become friends.
There is this explosion of publications in 2009 and 2010 and 2011, and then it never stops on your CV. So I'm wondering, it must have been a very productive postdoc during this period of time from 2006 to 2009. It seems like a lot of things were ready to go out. That's what it seems like on the CV, but I don't know.
So. Yeah, I mean, you know, like these were the days when I could score that position for 3 years with, I had no publications.
Right, yeah.
I hadn't even finished my PhD. I remember that last session with Nick and Alistair where I was like, this must be the last time. And then they're like, there's still something. So I had to kind of basically rock up and talk to Alex and say, hey, look, they think I need another 2 months or 3 months, you know, to kind of finish it and stuff. And so he was really cool and really great and supportive about that. But, you know, like I rocked up without any of those things that, you know, you would need now even get a look in to be shortlisted. So that was, probably like one of the last generations where that was possible.
Absolutely. Every Gen Xer-ish or adjacent to Gen X that I've interviewed, we all have that. And no matter where you are in the academy, like where you are geographically, it was the same thing. It was like we could still do that. We could think. We could be creative. We could really think about, you know, what it was that we wanted to do instead of publish or perish or whatever.
Yeah.
And then after that, it just ended.
Yeah. But, you know, I'd never – so no one had ever introduced me to the publishing game, right? Mm-hmm. And so that was then a process of figuring that out. Was that the same? So, like, you know, using stuff that I'd been working on, obviously, in the PhD to try to turn into articles, but then also starting new interests, mm-hmm. right? And that was sort of where that lingering thing from Brown and film and media and that sort of stuff mm-hmm. started coming in and kind of branching out from, you know, my existing interests in war and conflict and violence to, like, a media mm-hmm. element of that. Which was great fun doing something that I'd been waiting for a long time. Mm-hmm.
How did you get to cultivate the making of film itch that you had after you got to Australia? Right? Was it, you know, meeting up with folks at ISA, reconnecting with James even before he went to
Sydney? Yeah. So he was very great and like. Kept inviting me to come back to Brown for various things. And then obviously at ISA, where like usually some of those sessions were tied around like film and filmmaking and that stuff. And and at some point, I met a scholar in Japan, Peter Mantello, who is in sort of media study stuff. And he's a professor there. And he sort of said, hey, with your interests, you should really make a film documentary. It's like, yes, exactly. That's what I've always thought I should do. And he said, well, why don't we sort of try and make one together? And prior to the ISA in New Orleans, we traveled through all the way from New York down the coastline to New Orleans and interviewed all sorts of different people and filmed at different locations just to sort of test the waters.
Uh-huh.
And in that process, we interviewed someone who he had read and liked, Professor Roger Stahl at the University of Athens in Georgia, UGA, who I didn't know. And that's how I came across Roger and his work. And for a while then, the documentary didn't lead to anything, but we had all these interviews. And for a while, Peter, Roger, and I ran this website called The Vision Machine, where we had like sort of micro documentaries we were making, be this interviews with people or short sort of clips and that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. And that kind of was for me an opportunity to test myself with a bit of editing here and there, right? Mm-hmm. And sometimes, but you're curating a website and that sort of stuff. So that was kind of an early outlet mm-hmm. for that. And then subsequently, I did a MOOC, a massive open online course on global media, war and peace. And UQ back in those days was big on like, was one of the founding members of edX. Mm-hmm. And if you got one of those gigs, I got something like $65,000 for the production. One bit bought me out of a course, but then the rest was, I said, well, if I want to do something on that, I want to actually take students who can take this online course for free on a trip around the world and meet interesting people, visit interesting places, and then got a good friend from also high school who is a professional filmmaker, Carsten, who, you know, didn't ask for the salary he would normally get, but was just interested in coming along and having uh-huh. like a kind of, I don't know, 30-40 day road trip
uh-huh.
on a string budget. And so I think we did something like, I don't know, 24 interviews in like 11 different locations across 8 different countries or something like that. It was just really crazy, right? But it was great. Like, You know, we interviewed Glenn Greenwald in Rio. We filmed at the Institute for Creative Technologies in Los Angeles. We interviewed Richard Gisbert from The Listening Post in London, and, you know, filmed at the Stasi Archives in Berlin, and like all this sort of different stuff. And of course, I had this whole team from UQ. Like, there was a team of, you know, graphic designers and editors and learning designers who were working with me and who would do the editing. But, you know, we produced nearly 60 short YouTube videos of a length between 3 to 11 minutes. And I had to write the storyboard, right? So this was the closest to filmmaking that I had come. And yeah, and then, of course, as you know, like through the work and the, you know, the research I've done with Roger Stahl, he then asked me to if I would like to come on board for the latest documentary he was making.
Well, let's talk about that, which we've talked about quite a bit since you've so kindly visited and shared your time and energy here in Salt
because
Lake.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, listeners should know that we're sitting here in beautiful Salt Lake City, you know, yes. And so
I've got to see snow days. Last night.
That's right.
Yes.
That's right.
And so I hadn't seen Theaters of War. I wanted to wait until I was sitting there watching it for the first time at the screening last night. So, how did that come about? How did the funding come about? How did the process come about? Obviously, it sounds like you and Roger were on the same wavelength when it came to wanting to do this. But yeah, how did that come about?
So, you know, the interesting thing is that I had already developed this interest in, you know, media or digital or, you know, broadly in that direction. And so I had been doing stuff, researching stuff on embedded journalism. I had been doing stuff on the kind of evolution of the global media sphere and how it impacts on war and vice versa. And I had started writing about first-person shooter video games and Pentagon influence in the entertainment sector very broadly. Because I had, you know, a lot of great, wonderful things from that MOOC stuff, right? We interviewed the heads of the Pentagon Entertainment Liaison Office and his deputy and various others. So there was like amazing sound bites, and that kind of lent itself to it. So I've come from an IR perspective with an interest in war, engaging with media. Roger is a professor in communication studies who has always had an interest in the U.S. military and in war. Great book he wrote, Midetainment.inc, and a couple of others. So we kind of come to the same interest people from two different positions. And that made for, at the beginning, phenomenally interesting conversation. He's a very, very deep thinker and a very perceptive person, and also very funny and just great human being to hang out with. And so we have, well, we did that Vision Machine thing, right? But then also I did a special issue with the Australian Journal of International Affairs, so he came on board for that. And then we co-authored two pieces together. So we kind of have been working together for a while, and despite the distance and stuff, that has been going really well. And then he was a visiting scholar at UQ.
Okay.
I was a visiting scholar at UGA a couple of years ago. And so, you know, there was a close connection, and we knew of each other's work and that sort of stuff. And so Roger had then took an interest also in, you know, Pentagon and CIA influence in Hollywood, had started doing some preliminary research, came across these two British guys, an academic, Matthew Alford, and an investigative journalist, Tom Secker, who had been writing about some of that sort of stuff, and who in particular had been doing a lot of Freedom of Information Act requests with these entertainment liaison offices of the Pentagon and the CIA, that had resulted already in a large number of declassified documents. And they were willing to hand them over to us. And out of looking into these and making more FOIA requests and really starting to dig into this, it became clear that this is something we want to research together. But then Roger, who had, I mean, he's primarily an academic, right, and has wonderful, wonderful, strong research work, but he has always made like small documentaries on the side. Usually after he has published a book, he would then make a documentary about the book theme. But this time he's like, we should really make a documentary about this. And do you want to come on board? And so, it was like Matt, Tom, Roger, and myself. I mean, you know, to Roger's credit, he did most of the work very clearly, right? But so I came on board with that. You know, we could use some of those, the interview footage that, I produced. Yeah. We together interviewed various people who are featuring in the documentary.
Not just filmmakers, but also other academics that have studied this. The TCU professor that
yes.
you interviewed.
Yeah, I mean, Tanner Merlis yes. and Trisha Jenkins yes. and a couple of others. I mean, the field of people who have, there's a lot of people who have written about this, but the field of people who have really dug deep into this is not that big. Mm-hmm. And so we got a lot of those people involved. And and the whole thing was produced during COVID, so we never met, the four of us. Mm-hmm. So far to this day, we have never met in person, all together.
Really?
I've never met Tom and Matt.
So not at like
Roger
film premieres or
no,
for
nothing.
Awards?
No,
or?
No, nothing. Nothing so far, right? And so at some point that'll happen, but it's interesting to see how it's possible to do that, right?
Mm-hmm. How do you approach, so we talked about filmmaking and editing. How do you approach writing?
Yeah, so I come to it kicking and screaming.
Has it always been that way?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Okay.
And it takes me 4 to 5 days of writing, and then the kicking and screaming disappears, and I'm feeling I'm in a flow, and it's okay, and sometimes it's fun. But it's not that I come to this with like the greatest joy of it all, and it's a really I need to discipline myself a lot, and I'm a much better writer if I have consecutive days of writing. I never write in the office. I only write at home.
Okay.
Yeah, I've got quiet. No one disturbs me, you know, and I just sort of can stick with my own rhythm doing that.
Certain time of day. That's better.
It used to be any time but before 10 a.m. and now I've become this early bird. So I get up at like 5:30, 6 in the morning, and that's the golden hours of my day. Yeah. So like I can sit down by like 6 a.m. with a coffee and it's crystal clear. Usually I go for a run first and then start writing right away. Mm-hmm. And it's just beautiful. You know, and so then 3-4 hours of doing that is my one. I got very concerned that I went from like a night owl to an early bird. And once I talked to my GP about this, and she's got this really wicked sense of humor, and she was with her deep voice, and like, welcome to old age.
Yes, I was just going to say.
You know? I mean, you know, and you queue every year before the new semester or before the new timetable is being arranged, which becomes, you know, it used to be 6 months before, now it's 12 months before. Yep. By the time I retire, it will be 3 years before.
Yes.
We are getting asked if there are certain days or hours of the day when you can't teach, and you need to give reasons, so you need to drop the kids off or other obligations. But not being a morning person, you could never put in.
Mm-hmm.
And if you ask Richard Devitek, my former head of school, I would then, you know, say like, nothing before 10 a.m. I mean, you know, the options are from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. teaching.
Sure.
And so I was like, not before 10 a.m. I can't do a good job. I'm not a morning person. And then he would come back and say like, well, you know, I can't accept this because the university doesn't recognize this, which would then trigger me to download the latest research of medicine of how actually there is different biological clocks and all that. And anyway, so now I don't need this. It's more like, please don't let me teach until 8 p.m. So morning hours clearly are there. And ideally, it's the most productive it really is when it's not the semester, you know, and you have like those long summer breaks.
That's
or like
right.
you have a month or 2 months where you can just sort of really write yourself into a rhythm. So I try to do the kind of bigger project writings like the book that or other things like in those periods, or if you are lucky enough to have a sabbatical, and then it's sort of articles during the semester, you know, where it's easier to go in and out.
Yeah. Do you start with like an outline?
Always.
Okay.
Really? Yes.
Yeah.
It's always like what's very PhD, like what's the puzzle? Uh-huh. What's the research question?
Therefore, and so you start, and will you just sit down and you're not going to stop until, or you're not going to proceed further through like the, you know, what will ultimately become like the second section or the penultimate section or the conclusion until you kind of have the puzzle figured out, the start figured out, the hook?
Well, I wouldn't start. I mean, if I don't know anything about the subject, then, you know, you better do some reading to figure this out. But if you have, you feel like you have enough to come up with a puzzle, then I would start, you know. And then, of course, you revisit the puzzle and it becomes these moving parts in many ways.
So you're also a fellow podcaster.
That's true.
And we were talking about this morning, the Higher Ed Heroes podcast. How did that come about? How did... You've been doing it for 4 years now. So.
Yeah, so I love teaching, sometimes to the detriment, you know, of the research, and sometimes overburden myself with that. But you know, I indicated earlier at some point I thought maybe I'm going to become a high school teacher, and I've always enjoyed like thinking about like, how do you actually package the content that we know into something that is meaningful for students to help them learn? And I find that fascinating and fun. And if you are allowing yourself to experiment and do something different, it can be extremely rewarding and enriching. And, you know, there's so many different ways in which that can be done. And I've always sought out colleagues who are similarly minded, and I've got this amazing colleague and very good friend, Al Stark, who joined UQ in our school, maybe like 13 years ago or so, and we'd just have these exchanges. His office is across the corridor from mine, and you know, like he'd rock up to my office and like, "Hey, I wanted." This didn't work in my course, and maybe how can I do this differently? Or he'd be like, I want to do this, but I'm not really sure. What do you think if I teach it like that? Or I'd have a question. And we'd have these conversations about just pure, what do we do in the classroom? And then, you know, we'd occasionally meet for lunch outside our building on a bench. Mm-hmm. And he'd be with a sandwich, me with a coffee. We call them our coffee sandwich chats. and you know, it's just joy to, you know, sometimes spend some time talking about this teaching. And at some point, we're like, and we both have been sitting on the teaching and learning committee, right? And we're like, the teaching and learning committee doesn't talk about teaching.
Yes.
And the faculty teaching and learning committee doesn't talk about teaching.
That's right.
And the university teaching and learning committee doesn't talk about teaching. They talk about the administration of teaching. Mm-hmm. Like, but, you know, we love talking about the teaching stuff. And so we felt like, well, you know, maybe we should just sort of try and see what other people do and say and do this over a podcast and experiment with that medium. And then we convinced the faculty to get some seed funding from the Teaching and Learning Committee, where we really hit them on the fingers and like, well, you know, you guys don't do this, but we want to, you know, and so it was a bit of an experiment, and that allowed us to do a first season where we identified it because it was faculty funding, like, you know, find good teachers across our faculty, humanities and social sciences. But it was great, you know, you talk to people in other disciplines about what they do, and it's really then about, you know, the title Higher Ed Heroes is a bit misleading. It's not about like people who are awesome at teaching. It's about people who have dared to do something different in their classrooms. And for trying that, they are heroes for us. And then to focus on, and we always vet all the people we bring onto the podcast, because not everyone has the kind of thing you'd need in terms of an audio voice, or maybe what they're doing is not that great, or maybe what they're doing is great, but they can't talk about it. But it was always about things that can be replicated for people across other disciplines, and they're easy to implement stuff. you know? And it's sort of 20 minutes max episodes, and it just became a lot of fun doing that. And then it took off in ways we never expected. Like all of a sudden, you know, our listenership grew, and then it grew beyond UQ, and all of a sudden, you know, now we are sitting somewhere on like nearly 75,000 downloads from people across 100 countries, and it has been ranked amongst the top 10 podcasts on tertiary education worldwide. And it's just like, it's just really funny. And then every year it's become a struggle to get the funding for it because it's just a bit of an oddity, you know. But yeah, it's been going on for 4 seasons now. And, you know, it's a fun thing. It's very hard to organize.
Yeah, it's time, right?
As you would know. But once you're sitting in the studio, it's a lot of fun.
It's so much fun. So you have healthy routines. We've talked about this, you and I, the last few days. As we get older, we have to figure out what our healthy routines are. So what do you do to take care of yourself, to decompress, to, you know, what are your fun recreational things? Do you still play tennis?
No, I haven't played tennis. I used to play tennis a lot with our common good friend Matt McDonald.
Ah, okay.
And we even for a while had a team with his brother and the Little Lebowski Urban Achievers. but then we had COVID.
Sure.
I mean, tennis, it's ridiculous that, you know, it's a no-contact sport, but you're allowed to play it.
Yeah.
And then Matt had problems with his hip, so that kind of died down. And then another good friend who I used to play with regularly, they moved away. So I haven't really been on the tennis court in a while. Instead, I jog three times a week. I cycle at least one day on the weekends, and I cycle to work.
Meditation?
Of course.
Yeah.
Yoga and meditation, that's been a big part of my life for 13, 14 years now. And like not the yoga, but the meditation I do once a day. That's a very regular thing. I'm still learning, but I'm much better at setting limits to myself. I had to learn the hard way that the workplace I am in, I'm sure you are in as well, and our listeners are in, is like not the one that would ever set boundaries for you.
That's right.
The expectations seem to increase year by year.
I was going to say it's quite the opposite. It's expanding. Opposite, it's expansionist when it comes to that boundaries.
And until a few years ago, I was unable to actually see that, and I was overburdening myself with work. I would work like 7 days a week, and it was very unhealthy, and I became very sick and then had to really change my life around. And so one, besides getting healthy, it was also about learning to set boundaries. So I've decided that I'm working maximum. I'm working Monday to Friday. I'm working maximum 9 hours a day, and that's it. And if that means that I'm progressing slower in my academic career, then so be it, right? And it was a really good way to kind of evaluate what my own values were, right? And that was really great to rediscover certain things or reintegrate certain things into life. So, for example, with COVID, fiction reading has become a huge thing. With a few friends, we have a little book club where we meet, you know, four times a year.
Oh, yeah.
But always, like, the person who suggested this is hosting and cooks nice food, and then, you know, and no one is allowed to have read the book that we're all reading. But beyond that, so like fiction reading has become really, really big. Music has come back in. For a long time, Matt and I have been, you know, meeting irregularly and playing some music. But I started.
What do you play?
I sing.
You do.
I'm a shitty guitar player.
Okay, but he plays the guitar then.
Yeah. And
he also plays the piano
and the piano, and he's got a great voice. So we're doing actually quite good harmonies, right? I used to play violin. That was the instrument in my teenage years, or like, you know, when I was small. But I started playing bass 2.5 years ago, and that's become a really big thing. So I play every day, even if it's 5 minutes. And then through some other friends, they asked me if I want to join them you know, they have a regular gig at one of the West Toowong Bowls clubs in Brisbane. You know you've made it musically if you have once every 2-3 months a gig at a kind of Sunday afternoon with like drunken Aussies trying to play lawn bowls and eating stuff from like food trucks and stuff, right? But it's like, it's great fun because it really like has brought me back in touch with, playing music and obviously helps me enormously in learning and getting better.
Can we set up an ISA where you just play for one of the receptions, maybe?
Oh my God. I think that was something people did. And I remember Nita Crawford playing something.
Yeah, and then there was Alex, one of his books won. Well, probably a bunch of his books have won awards, but one of his books won the best book in international ethics section. Mm. And he couldn't be there, but Nita was hosting it. And I'm bringing my grad students into an ISA for the first time. And the very first panel we go to is the roundtable on the book. And Nita is playing Happy, the song Happy. Because, of course, Alex's book is about massacres or something, right? I mean, it's just like something that's like horrible. And so she's playing it and she's dancing. And it's like, this is the first experience, the first formative experience my grad students have is like her playing music. So it would not surprise me if either she was performing music, singing, or was playing it. But that's wonderful.
Yeah. I'm not sure if it's a good idea.
Well, we could come back to that.
We could try, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, you'd be surprised, right? I mean, there's so many phenomenal musicians amongst our colleagues.
That's right, yeah.
You know?
And then there's folks like me that can't do anything but listen and try to dance.
What would you play?
I wouldn't. I juggle. I can juggle.
Well, there we go.
Yeah, and then I can karaoke. But not sing, just hip hop, and that's it, which is very limited.
Yeah, that's all right. You're the Anthony Kiedis of IR.
I am an Anthony Kiedis, although I would not subject anybody to me singing anything with my shirt off. So, Dr. Sebastian Kampf, thank you so much for being on the Hayseed Scholar podcast.
That's been fun. Thanks so much.
Cheers.
Okay, that was my conversation with Sebastian Kampf of the University of Queensland. Seb and Matt, I'm about to see them a little bit later this afternoon as I am recording this on Monday of ISA week. I'm already here in San Francisco. The weather is gorgeous. And so I got up pretty early this morning and walked over to some of the piers. I'm in the Fisherman's Wharf neighborhood. And so my plan is to take a cable car each morning down to the conference, only about a 15 to 20 minute trip, while I can also sort of get back here and kind of crash each evening a little bit earlier after a host of meetings each day. But this afternoon, it should be a lot of fun. I have some coffee meetings and then I'm meeting them for a happy hour, beer or two at some of the breweries here in San Francisco. The expectation is that Chris Aegis and a few other folks are going to be there. So it should be a lot of fun. But because the workshops and panels here at ISA and committee meetings and summits and roundtables and so on and so forth start up tomorrow all the way through Saturday morning, I'll hopefully get back to this hotel and crash a little bit early each night. But I hope you are all doing well. And for those that are here in San Francisco this week or that were here in San Francisco this week, I hope I got to see you. But even if I didn't, I hope you had a wonderful week here. And for everyone else, I hope that you are doing well. And like I said, there will be at least one more episode that I'll launch or at least conduct and then edit before my shoulder surgery, which is scheduled for Friday, April 12th. And so if many of you are trying to contact me for any time of 2 weeks or 3 weeks thereafter, and I'm not responding, that's why. I'm going to be laid up at my house healing and probably figuring out ways to get Chase Pup some exercise, because I will be unable to do that through what we typically do, which is walking. Okay. Until next time, everyone, hope you're doing well, and cheers.